This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Readers of the New York Times Modern Love column recently found an essay by an Iowan, Jennifer Percy. She's attending the University of Iowa nonfiction writing program. The column is called Even in English, a Language Gap. Percy says, people are always trying to educate me about dating foreigners. She's been dating a man for 3 years who is a native of the Balkans and spent his teens in Germany. His first language is Serbo-Croatian. So Percy has learned a lot about dating a foreigner and how the language of love can get lost in the translation. We'll talk to her about her essay. And later, UNI professor Jeffrey Copeland, author of Olivia's Story, discusses a landmark civil rights case which held that courts could not enforce racial covenants on real estate. Talk of Iowa in 5 minutes following Iowa Public Radio and NPR News. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Saying I love you to someone else is a fairly straightforward message, especially if you both speak the same language. But if you're from Oregon and your boyfriend grew up in the Balkans, he may interpret it differently than volam te, which is the same phrase in Serbo-Croatian. Jennifer Percy talks about these communication challenges in a column entitled Even in English, a Language Gap, which was published recently as a Modern Love column in the New York Times. Percy is a student in the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa.
My boyfriend is Bosnian, and he moved to Germany when he was a teenager. English is his third language. But we met in America, and so I knew him first and foremost as an English speaker. I didn't even hear him speak German until 3 months into the relationship. So the first time I heard him speak German, it was rather strange. It seemed like someone was talking through him, like the words weren't his own. And this made me question the significance of what he said when he spoke English to me. Can words in a foreign language really carry as much weight as they do in the original language? How long do you need to study a language before it feels the same as your original? And now, I studied Spanish for several years in college, and when I went to Spain for a year abroad, I dated a man there who spoke no English. After several months, I said, te amo, I love you, to him. But when I said te amo, it just felt like words. It didn't feel like I love you. And he seemed to sense this and told me never to say those words again unless I really meant them. And the point being, not that we couldn't communicate, we could, but that the words were still objects I was throwing around. And when you speak another language, there's really a period where you don't feel self-conscious at all about speaking because the words aren't yet attached to meaning. Then later the words become significant. They carry weight and collect associations. For example, when you swear in another language, it's just a sound. The sound isn't yet connected to its meaning. A word has to develop meaning over time. So I've actually never reached a level of fluency where I love you in a language carry the same emotional weight as I love you in English.
Now, when you're dating someone, Jennifer, you have language and then you have body language because it's a romantic relationship. The body language portion speaks true, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the language, the actual language, that's confusing. So what was his actual problem with te amo? He didn't feel you were really knew what it meant? Or, I mean, what was his point again?
Well, I think te amo is used less frequently in Spanish. I love you is used less frequently in Spanish than it is in America. And they actually use the phrase te quiero more frequently, which means literally I want you, but is used frequently to show affection between couples. And so I think he was startled by my sudden use of te amo. And I said it sort of freely and repeated it in a way that seemed a bit too nonchalant. And so I think he was doubting that I really knew the words.
Do English speakers use the word love more often, do you think? It seems like it's a very commonly used word in English.
I think that in Germany they use love much more frequently than in America. And they use the word Liebe for love to begin an email or a letter, whereas we say dear. And so to a foreigner, someone who doesn't speak German, can become quite confusing when the word is used so frequently. You know, you never know when it's being used romantically versus when it's being used formally. They also end their letters more frequently using Liebe than we do. There's some other words, too, that can be confusing. In German, the word for girlfriend and friend are actually the same, Freundin, which is another opportunity for confusion if you're going into this culture without knowing any German at all.
reading somewhere that in some cultures there's more permutations on the word love. There's more variations of the word love in some, actually some tribal languages, and English has just the one word. I don't know what the significance of that is from your perspective, but love can mean all sorts of different things, can't it?
Well, in German, they actually have two stages before you say I love you. There's Lieben, which is to love, and Verlieben, which is falling in love. Mm. And before you get to love, you're supposed to use Verlieben. And it's actually funny because with me and my boyfriend, we skipped that step. He went straight to Liebe. He didn't use Verlieben, but of course, I didn't know he had skipped this step. And I said, right, I love you right back to him without even knowing that there was this gap.
Ich liebe dich, mm-hmm. right? Am I mm-hmm. saying that right? Yeah. Jennifer, this column called Even in English, a Language Gap was accepted by the New York Times in their Modern Love column, which is on Sundays only, right?
Yes.
And you just submitted this to them? They didn't ask for it?
No, I submitted it to the slush pile.
The slush pile. Explain what a slush pile is, because I'm not sure everyone knows.
Well, a slush pile means that anyone can send in their story. You don't have to be an established writer to send your work in. And the editor will go through everything, despite your background or experience.
Well, let's go. Let's focus now on the main point of the article. You've been dating a man who is originally from Bosnia. His parents live in Florida. They're Bosnian. They left Bosnia to go to Germany. He was raised in Germany?
He was raised in Bosnia.
How old was he when they moved to Germany then?
He lived in Bosnia for 16 years.
How did you meet him?
I actually met him in America, in Iowa.
Really?
He was a writer at the International Writing Program here.
And he speaks Bosnian and German and English, but his first language is?
Is Bosnian, correct.
Is Bosnian. How's his German?
He's fluent in German.
How's his English?
He's apparently fluent in English, too, but there are obviously these translation issues we have.
And what about you?
Oh, I don't speak any of the—I don't speak Bosnian or German.
Okay.
I just studied Spanish.
I guess the focus of the article is the difficulty of dating foreigners. Is the language difficulty the major problem?
Well, I think that the language or the danger is twofold. First, I think a foreign language can allow for excuses to be made and for meaning to be reformed, because an issue can inevitably be blamed on translation. But the second issue is actually one of the imagination, because if you don't immediately understand something, you'll carry the words with you and attach your own meaning to them, and things can spiral out of control very fast.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah. For example, he would often say this phrase, "I was so in love with you there," or "I just fell in love with you again." As if love wasn't constant, but happened only in moments. And of course, that's not something you want someone to say to you. But when I finally asked him about this, he was rather confused about my interpretation, because apparently there's a phrase in German whose direct translation is, "I just fell in love with you again," but which actually means a moment when you realize again why you are in love with someone. It's actually an outburst of love, a sudden realization again of falling in love, you know, which is quite lovely and something more beautiful than I have in my own language.
You say in the article, Jennifer, you once tried saying "Volim te," "I love you," in Serbo-Croatian, and he didn't respond. So why not?
Well, my theory is that if you say "I love you" in the original language, it has more weight, it carries more meaning. And so I think he was actually shocked by hearing mm-hmm. it in his original language, and perhaps it carried more significance and more emotional weight than "Ich liebe dich" or "I love you."
If you end up marrying this man and you commit to him, would you then at that point decide to learn Serbo-Croatian just to make it an easier permanent relationship, do you suppose?
I don't think I would learn Serbo-Croatian, but I'd certainly try to learn German.
Serbo-Croatian is probably difficult to learn, I suppose.
And I don't think enough people speak it. And also his family doesn't live there anymore.
Yeah.
We went there last summer for a vacation, but only his grandma lives there now.
Mm, okay. You first met him in, and we're not mentioning his name, and we're calling him your boyfriend. You met him in Iowa City. Everyone spoke English, and you note in the column, You had been together for 4 months before you even heard him speak in German. Well, what was it like when you first met him?
Well, it felt a little bit like a betrayal. It was rather strange. It seemed like someone was talking through him, like the words weren't really his own. And it was a little bit scary, but in a very comical way. And even now, he periodically blurts out things in German, and neither of us will say anything because he doesn't know what's wrong. And because I feel like I'm going crazy, you know, did I just hear that right? What was that sound? Did I not understand something? Okay.
What are your normal conversations like with him when you're just chatting about the weather or something? Is it a lot easier to just have to talk about the weather or something in the news than to talk about your feelings?
Yeah, I think actually it's just in the area of love where things can get complicated.
Really?
Otherwise, I wouldn't notice any translation issues because I wouldn't really dwell on the words as much.
Okay. But when it gets intimate, then you'd start dwelling on the words, things get lost in the translation, feelings can get hurt pretty easily, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happened a number of times, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's important to understand that, you know, even when we speak in English, what we say rarely correlates to what we mean. The movement from thought to language is already transformative. You know, just as when we paint, what we see before us on the canvas rarely matches the original vision. And so, you know, when we're talking about love, there's also lots of subtext going on, and that can be easily missed. It's usually when we're talking about love, we don't speak directly about it. We can kind of move around it. You know, that's why in English we often say, oh, I'm falling in love with you, but that's actually not a step before I love you. It's sort of a euphemism. It's a way to protect ourselves from getting to that statement, I love you.
Yeah. Is that the ultimate statement then in English, I love you?
I think so.
Really? Yeah.
What okay. about you?
I suppose. And now, you mentioned subtext. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a little bit hard to explain, but I think that, you know, it has to go along with this idea that, you know, we're not always saying exactly what we mean, and there's subtleties in the language. For example, if I asked him, oh, is that a girlfriend or something that was staying with you? The something carries the weight there. You know, what was going on between you? But perhaps it was someone who he'd had an intimate relationship with. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily a girlfriend, because girlfriend in Germany carries a lot more weight than it does here. They don't really date people there. It's either you're a girlfriend or you're not together. So that something would really just get lost in the translation. And later, you know, if there was something going on with this other woman, then the excuse would be in the translation. Oh, well, I didn't actually hear you say that something. It would become irrelevant.
You say subtext does not often transfer between languages, which is a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese talking with Jennifer Percy, University of Iowa graduate student in the nonfiction writing program and a fellow at the Museum of Art. Her article, Even in English, a Language Gap, published in the New York Times in their Modern Love column. We'll take a break for a minute, continue in a minute on Talk of Iowa. Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese talking to Jennifer Percy, University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program, article in the New York Times about the difficulty of relationships where different languages are spoken, romantic relationships, that is. And you say, Jennifer, early in our relationship, my boyfriend complimented a woman on her dress and I became upset. He said he was just being honest. I asked if he would mind if I complimented men, and he said he wouldn't, but I wished he would. Is this a cultural difference between a typical cultural difference between Germany, where he lives, and the United States?
Yes, I think Americans are generally a very polite culture. And going to Germany, I was a little bit shocked sometimes by their honesty, despite how beneficial that could, of course, be in your life. And one time when he was in Iowa, actually, we were buying some pants at the Coralville Mall, and the clerk said, oh, did you find everything okay? And, you know, our generic response is, oh, yes, even if you didn't. But, you know, of course, he came out with, oh, no, I didn't, actually. I didn't find what I needed at all. And so there's these little moments that kind of shock me sometimes where, you know, he doesn't have answers already formed for people. He's actually always very honest. And so even when you say, you know, how are you, it's not just a generic good or bad. It's, you know, a very honest response.
There's differences even within regions of the United States in the way people use language and how warm they are in addressing strangers, mm-hmm. for example, using, you know, words like honey and sweetie for strangers, men addressing women. Do you find there has to be these sorts of differences even accentuated between different countries and different languages, right?
Well, in Germany, I know that they have a group of friends of three or four people that they're very, very close and very, very affectionate with. And mm-hmm. they don't usually expand outside of that circle. And, you know, in America, we usually have lots and lots of acquaintances that we call our friends, but they don't call anyone their friend. It's a very exclusive group. And within this group of friends, they're extremely intimate, very affectionate physically and emotionally. So that's something that as an American going to Germany, you have to get used to. It's very easily confused with a romantic relationship, but simply they're more intimate there. I mean, you see girls holding hands all the time. You see them, you know, they kiss each other on cheek. That's very frequently in all European countries. But as an American, of course, that's something you always have to get used to. Even the physical distance when you're speaking is very close.
You're very close to his parents.
Mm-hmm.
And you spend a lot of time there. I mean, what's it like when you're there and he's not there and you just visit? And
well, I've only visited them once without him.
Without him, mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a very interesting story you tell about his father.
So when I went to visit his parents in Florida, they showed me a video of him receiving an award on a video they had saved, and it was all in German. And his father was interpreting the video for me. And at one point he said, oh, your boyfriend just said hello to you. He acknowledged you in his speech, in his thank you speech. And I was very excited and later went to talk to his mother about this and said, oh, did you hear what he said? He said thank you to me in his speech. And she said, oh, no, he didn't actually. And I found out his father was just telling me that because, you know, the distance was so great and we all missed him. He thought it would make me feel, you know, closer to him and feel happy. So it was actually a lie, but it was a very kind lie in a way.
Yeah.
And for me, I interpreted that as, you know, something he would want someone to do to him because they had been separated from their son for so long. So it was a gesture that kind of brought us all closer together for a moment.
How long now have you been dating?
3 years.
Are you finding the language gets easier as the longer you're together?
Yes, because now I don't hold statements with me that I don't understand. I realize that there are these issues in translation. And again, you know, because I met him in the United States, it wasn't something I really thought about going into the relationship. It just sort of came out of nowhere. You know, of course, I knew he was foreign, lived in a different country, but meeting him here and only interacting with him with Americans and English speakers for 3 to 4 months, it was a little bit of a shock to suddenly have to interact with him in a completely different culture. And I did study German for a semester, and that's helped immensely.
But I'm glad you two are doing well. And you're at this point, you've, I'm sure, established some real honesty about you can be honest with each other about words and phrases and what he means by something he said in German or Serbo-Croatian, and you can get that, you can work that out together a lot more easily?
Oh, certainly. And as I mentioned before, you know, he is a very honest person. It's a very honest culture. So it's not a matter really of honesty. It's a matter of me taking words with me and sort of trying to translate them on my own. You know, sometimes I'll even put words into Google, and, you know, that's just a really awful idea. It's much better to just work through the translation, accept that there's going to be these hurdles. And actually it can, you know, open up things more than it can close them.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, what are your plans? Are you looking for a career in journalism? Are you going to be writing books? I know you have a manuscript coming out as part of your final project, but...
Well, I'm graduating this year, and my plan is to finish a book project over the next couple of years and hopefully end up teaching at the college level. Mm-hmm. And my book project right now is about veterans returning to the U.S. and the war after the war, dealing with PTSD. And right now I'm focusing on a man, a special forces officer in Georgia, who suffers from severe PTSD.
And did you you prefer nonfiction over fiction then? You're in the nonfiction program.
I'm in the nonfiction program, and my work actually is fairly hybrid. I work with the tools of fiction and write primarily literary journalism and personal essays.
How does the nonfiction writing program differ from, let's say, the journalism programs? They're sort of the same thing, aren't they?
No, they're actually completely different.
Okay, explain. Because they're both nonfiction, and you're reporting facts, but you're saying they're different.
Well, nonfiction simply means truth. It's a genre, but it's much more complicated than that. There's also emotional truth. So when you're writing memoir, for example, and you go back in time to try to recreate a memory, you're not going to be recreating it exactly as it happened because memory is fallible. You can't do that. So you're going to be adding your own interpretation to the experience. Even though even if you're witnessing something happening before you, it's going to be a subjective interpretation. You're going to be noticing certain details. There's going to be certain things you would write and describe that no one else would describe. So even though it's not journalism because it's still a subjective act and you're adding more of yourself to the piece, it also allows for room to experiment with poetry and fiction. Most of my writing would read as fiction. It has narrative arc and scenes and uses dialogue. And without actually telling you beforehand that it was nonfiction, it could be easily read as a short story.
You're teaching an undergraduate course too?
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it said that undergraduates today are maybe not the writers that undergraduates were a generation ago. How are you finding your students' writing skills?
Well, I think the undergraduate program at the University of Iowa really benefits from having such a strong graduate writing program. And the undergraduates I've worked with have actually really impressed me. And, you know, we don't grade them on whether they come into the class as stellar writers, but on progress. And so that's really the reward of teaching, is seeing them progress throughout the semester. And as a teacher of nonfiction, it's really exciting because, you know, they go into nonfiction thinking, oh, I have to write an academic paper or an essay, but it really gives them more opportunities to mix genres and to experiment with form while still writing about their personal lives.
Can they spell?
No comment.
They have spell check. Jennifer, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jennifer Percy is a student in the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa and a fellow at the University of Iowa Museum of Art. Her column entitled, Even in English, a Language Gap, was the modern love column in a recent issue of the New York Times. Stay with us. Following a 5-minute break, we'll hear about a landmark civil rights case from a UNI professor who writes about Shelley versus Kramer in his new book, Olivia's Story.
You always heard the one you love, the one you shouldn't hurt at all. You always take the sweetest rose and crush it till the petals fall. You always break the kindest heart with a hasty word you can't recall. So if I broke your heart last night, it's because I love you most of all.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. The Supreme Court case Shelley versus Kramer was a landmark decision in civil rights in the United States. It made illegal restrictive covenants on property that would not allow people of color to occupy certain homes in certain neighborhoods. And while this court case is of great importance to U.S. history, the story behind the story may be even more interesting. A professor at the University of Northern Iowa has written a book about this. It's his second related to this case, and we'll explain all of that in just a moment. Jeffrey Copeland is the author of Olivia's Story and now joins us from our studios in Cedar Falls. Jeff, thanks for being on Talk of Iowa.
Well, good afternoon, Jonathan. Thank you for having me on the program.
Now, I think to get to where you ended up with Olivia's Story, you need to explain your first book a little bit and how you got those letters that kind of led you to discover this couple. So just to fill in that backstory, tell us about how you started with Inman. We'll start with that.
Well, I'd be happy to. This is every writer's dream come true, very much serendipity. If you can imagine this, I was at a flea market in Belleville, Illinois, several years ago with my relatives. I went up to one of the booths there. I found an old ratty suitcase loaded with old letters. They were tied together with twine. I opened a couple of the letters. I looked at them. Something in the voice and the letters touched me deeply. They were from a Sergeant Inman Perkins back to an Olivia Merriweather in St. Louis, Missouri. I looked at the outside of the envelope. I could see that they were written during World War II. I could also see from the envelope that Sergeant Perkins was in the 449th Colored Signal Construction Battalion of the Army Air Corps. I grew up in St. Louis, so I was interested in the history that the letters might have inside them. I never for a minute that day thought that I would write a book about this. It was just my curiosity. I've always been that kid, always curious. So I negotiated for the letters, and I actually went up to the individual selling them and said, "Sir, how much for your letters?" And he looked at me and said, "Son, you don't understand. It's the suitcase that's for sale." And I said, "No, you don't understand. I want the letters." And he said, and I'll never forget this, "No, you don't understand. If you don't buy that suitcase, you don't get the letters." So $30 later, I had 100 letters from Sergeant Perkins back to Olivia and about 30 letters from her back to him. It took me on a journey that I could never imagine in my wildest dreams. Everywhere across the United States, I ended up going to all the places where Inman's group had been stationed during World War II before they went overseas. And then I even did get to go overseas. His unit was instrumental in what happened in the European theater. So I got to do all of that. Out of that grew the book, Inman's War, A Soldier's Story of Life in a Colored Battalion in World War II. It was nominated for 5 national awards, and it's currently being made into a motion picture that I hope will be out relatively soon. From that experience, while I was writing that, I realized I had a second story, a wonderful story, and this was Olivia's story. I didn't know it when I bought the letters, but Olivia was really Inman's wife. But because of a St. Louis school board ruling at the time, they had to hide their marriage because at that time, in the early 40s, women who were teachers who got married were required by Board of Education rule to give up their jobs. So they were living this elaborate ruse. Well, in doing the research for Inman's War, as I mentioned, I had this wonderful information about one of the most beautiful people I had ever read about in my life, Olivia Merriweather Perkins. So that's the connection. That's how the two books sort of fit together. Olivia's story is not a sequel. I call it a sort of sequel because there are common characters and events between the two.
Now, you said that you ran into a second story, but really what this book is about is the third story that you found, because just what you started to write about Olivia Perkins was not the thing you ended up finishing the book about.
That's true. I always tell writers groups, never be afraid to make what I call a hard left turn when you find out that you have a different path to go on in your writing. I started writing about Olivia's teaching career at Sumner High School, Charles Sumner High School in St. Louis, Missouri, where some of her students were Tina Turner, Chuck Berry, Arthur Ashe, and a person who's become quite a good friend of mine, Dick Gregory. And I started writing about her career there, which spanned the late 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the early 70s until she retired. She was an incredibly gifted teacher who was voted to the list of the top 100 teachers of all time. I started writing about her teaching career, and I ended up stopping. And the reason I stopped is, A, the story was about as dry as a corn cob left out in the sun. I mean, it was interesting to me, but it's one of those things you have a pretty good sense when you're not really making it for an exciting story. But I was interviewing one of Olivia's relatives to find out about her mannerisms, the way she spoke, the way she carried herself. And while I was interviewing this relative, the relative said to me, "So, are you going to write about the murder?" And I looked up and I said, I beg your pardon, what did you say?" And she said, "You know, the murder." And she started going through the details and explained this to me. And I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked because it was related to Olivia's life and her story. So it was about a month later, I'm interviewing another relative, and the relative says, "So, are you going to write about the murder?" And I started going through the details from the first relative to see if the information matched. And she looked at me and said, "Young man, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm talking about this murder here." So it was a totally different murder that was related to the story. And then, so help me, it wasn't, but a couple months after that, I was interviewing another person who knew Olivia very well. And the person halfway through our interview said, "So, are you going to write?" And I finished the sentence, "About the murder?" And she said, "Are you?" And I said, "Yes, but I discovered," and I went through the information from the previous two. And she looked at me and said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I'm talking about this one." So the murders were starting to stack up like cordwood. And while the murders are not the main part of the book, they are important to what happened in the background information and how the events unfolded. So I threw away at that point everything I had written, and I started all over.
Now, I've read enough that I know that you're not too interested in giving out a lot of details about, because now we're talking about three murders, we're talking about a conspiracy, there's a lot of intrigue that's involved in here. And the way that you write the book, you really kind of leave it very open-ended. You leave a lot hanging out there that it feels like you kind of want the reader to come to some conclusions. Why did you choose that technique?
You're very good. Okay, first of all, I chose to do narrative nonfiction and write it in the voices of the characters for what I thought was a good reason. The Shelley versus Kramer decision is one of the most important Supreme Court rulings in the history of this country. It literally changed the color of the American landscape. But if you look at the legal information, it's pretty dry. So what I wanted to do was write it in the voices of the characters so that people would have the humanity behind the story and know the sacrifices made by people that came before us to make this country the way it is today. So that's the reason why it's told the way it is. But to answer your question more specifically, I was very conscious of the fact there's no statute of limitation on murder. So I was very careful in how I presented the information in the book. To be honest with you, I think I have a pretty good idea of what happened with one of them. But it's one of those things I wanted the reader to make a judgment on what happened. So I did leave it a little more open purposely just for that reason.
Well, it felt to me also that especially we're talking about a part of American history that I'd say the vast majority of Americans wouldn't be proud of, a law that did not treat people equally. And there's this almost sense of an end justifying the means that you may be suggesting at, be it in real crimes or perceived crimes or a group of people doing something a little bit underhanded. It was that kind of in your mind as well to kind of leave it open and let people decide because of, I mean, if this was about something other than a major piece of civil rights legislation, would you have gone the same route?
You know, for most of the religions of the world that I have read about, it's wrong to take a life under any circumstances. But if a life were ever going to be taken, there were a couple of individuals involved in this story that absolutely got what they deserved. Now, I shouldn't say that out loud. I'll probably be struck by lightning on the way out of here. But I wanted people to study the events and the actions and then determine for themselves if they felt a certain course of action that took place was justified or whether maybe it wasn't just intervention of some kind.
You mentioned the ruling itself being kind of dry and wanting to give it a human voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the ruling itself, the Supreme Court actually didn't rule that the covenant was illegal. What it ruled was that the court couldn't enforce the covenant, which I think it may be legal mumbo-jumbo, but it seemed like the court was trying to find a way to strike down the law without saying the law was illegal.
You know, you're absolutely correct. You have to remember that this time in our history, it was a political powder keg to talk about issues of equality with the races. The original suit that was brought in the St. Louis Circuit Court ruled one way, the Missouri Supreme Court ruled another way, and then when it got to the Supreme Court ruling, they actually did take sort of a dodge. They actually did say it is not illegal to create restrictive covenants. However, it is illegal to enforce them. So basically they said, sure, go ahead. You can make all the restrictions you want, but the courts are not going to support you. And in making this particular ruling, what they said was the 14th Amendment prohibits a state from enforcing restrictive covenants, which would prohibit a person from owning or occupying property on the basis of race or color, but they did it by saying it in that way. They did it by saying, go ahead, create it. We're not going to enforce it.
Do you think there was a certain amount of foreshadowing involved in this case also? Because one of the lawyers who argued the companion case, McGee v. Sipes, which was kind of combined with this one, was Thurgood Marshall, who ended up being the first African-American on the Supreme Court. Do you think that gives this case a sense of foreshadowing as well?
Incredible foreshadowing. It actually mirrors a lot of what took place in getting to Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, all the way up through the early 60s, and what happened with a lot of the civil rights activities at that time. But, you know, while it's true that McGee versus Sipes was attached to this at the Supreme Court, there was actually another case that most people simply don't know about that took place in Washington, D.C., that involved a gentleman of Native American descent who was denied occupation of a piece of property there because he was Native American. So it wasn't just an issue of African American and Caucasian. There were several other pieces that were thrown in at the same time.
Now, we've talked the last few minutes here, we've been talking about a little more of the hard history of it. Your book it certainly reads like a novel. You said that some things were modified and compressed a little bit. Some names were changed. Is this a piece of fiction or is this nonfiction?
No, it's nonfiction. It's narrative nonfiction. Narrative nonfiction is a type of writing whereby all the major facts and events are true, but the author is allowed to flesh out the voices of the characters and the time period that's involved. The original situation with this case, the original suit was brought in St. Louis Circuit Court by Fern and Lewis Kramer in October of 1945, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling wasn't until 1948. So to make it a more focused narrative and to have the flow better, I compress some of the time. But each one of the events in the story is true. So it is absolute nonfiction. But what the characters say at a given time, whether it be at an event or a party or something like that, I had to flesh out. But here's the toughest part of writing narrative nonfiction. For every character in the story, I interviewed people who were either relatives of theirs or people who knew them quite well or both to find out different things like, you know, what they said, how they said it, how they dressed, their motives, things like that. So I had a very good feel for what the characters were like. So even in writing dialogue for the characters, I felt I had from the other information a very good handle on it.
Let's give the listeners a flavor of what this book reads like. Can you read a passage? And maybe before you do, just kind of explain whose voice you wrote the book in, and so we have a little bit of backstory on where we are at this point in the book.
Thank you. I'd be happy to. This is Olivia's voice. When the five, I'll call them co-conspirators, or conspirators, got together to make the plan to purchase the property on Labadie Avenue, we can talk about that in a minute. When they all got together, they talked over a little bit about the plan, and these were Olivia's thoughts as this was all explained to her, what they were going to do. This is in the chapter called Covenants. I didn't have to think long about this, not at all. I knew what many of the consequences could be if we were caught, but at the same time, I also knew what this could mean if we were successful. If everything fell as planned, we'd be able to put at least a small hole in the invisible fence surrounding the ville. The Shelleys were just one family, but if we could stop, at least temporarily, the advance of the mission of the real estate exchange, we might be able to open doors to possibilities none of us thought would ever be possible in our lifetimes. It would be risky, very risky, but it was also a risk I felt worth taking, one that had to be taken. I looked at the others, and I saw it in their eyes as well. Suddenly, from deep in my heart, I knew there was only one thing to say. "I'm in," I said to the group. "I know I should probably ask a million questions, but I'm not going to. I've heard enough for now. There's only one question I want answered before we leave today. What's our first step?" And that's a scene where, as I mentioned, the conspirators get together. They talk about the plan of action they're going to do. This provided the foundation for Shelley versus Kramer.
That's Jeff Copeland reading from Olivia's story, The Conspiracy of Heroes Behind Shelley v. Kramer, which is published by Paragon House. Now, Jeff, that isn't William Ambrose, and that's certainly not Doris Kearns Goodwin. So if someone is a student of U.S. history, why should they take this narrative fiction to heart, and how do you believe that while we understand the research that you've done into it, your own personal writing style, your own personal interpretation is certainly in there. How does that play into a student of history wanting to know more?
Sure. As I mentioned, this really started taking place in 1945, so we're talking over 60 years ago. Most of the principals involved in the story are well into their 80s, some are in their 90s, and some have passed on. Shelley versus Kramer is a series of words and a bunch of legal documents. I read all the documents for all three of the different court cases. And as I mentioned, this is something that, while it's significant for why we are where we are today, a lot of it has been lost in the sands of time. The way the book is written and the voices of the characters brings back the humanity behind what had to take place in order for this to evolve. It's the sacrifices. It's the dignity possessed by the individuals in these stories that is often the forgotten part of history. This is a time period in American history that was so volatile, yet these people came together without regard for their own personal safety and well-being to do something they felt was right. And I'd like people today, whether they're younger readers or whether they're people more my age, to understand the sacrifices made by those before us. And I wanted that to be expressed by showing the humanity, by showing that these were real people who did the most amazing acts in a very selfless way. Does that sort of answer your question?
Sure. I hate to get into supposition here, but I'm wondering if part of the motivation is also to start talking about in depth the people who were involved in the civil rights movement who weren't Martin Luther King, or who weren't Rosa Parks, who weren't all great people, but though the people that are always mentioned, and you know, being it's February, it's Black History Month, it seems like those same dozen leaders are all always talked about for their great accomplishments. But I'm wondering if trying to focus on the average foot soldier in the civil rights issue and how significant their contributions were. May have been part of your motivation in taking the book in that direction.
A lot of motivation. You are absolutely correct that we hear about a lot of the larger significant issues and events that took place. But as you mentioned, I think you called them the foot soldiers out there. There are a lot of those whose activities have really been lost in time. But take, for example, the attorney for the side of the Shelleys in this particular case, George Vaughn. He was an attorney, a very prominent attorney in St. Louis who took on the case. It actually became his life. He did one of the best jobs of presenting a case that I have ever heard about, I've ever seen. He devoted the rest of his life to spreading word about Shelley versus Kramer to law schools, to law students, and it just became all-consuming to him. And there are so many attorneys today that say he is the reason why they became attorneys or they got interested in the law, yet that's a name that's been lost in history. And the same can be said for all the major players in this story. They were people who did amazing things that did not get the credit for it at the time, and again, because this was a very volatile time in history. Take Mrs. Fitzgerald, for example, the straw buyer in the story. She was a pariah after the ruling came down from the St. Louis Circuit Court and actually had to move away from St. Louis because a lot of people thought what she did was really horrible.
Jeff Copeland is the author of Olivia's Story, The Conspiracy of Heroes Behind Shelley v. Kramer. It is published by Paragon House Publishers. Jeff Copeland is the professor and head of the Department of English and Literature at the University of Northern Iowa. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all the time we have for Talk of Iowa today. The program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Phil Moss. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.